I'm an alcoholic, but he still has money. And on June 4th of 2013, that was almost 10 years ago, somebody got sober. And she started making a ruckus. She started getting involved in groups and getting a sponsor and working steps. And she's gone on to be a sponsor. She's gone on to do some really important service in our community. One of the service committees that AA has is the H&I, or Hospitals and Institutions Committee. And our speaker tonight has made an enormous impact on that service community. She's responsible for a significant amount of growth in the number of volunteers that we currently have. And we're really excited about the role that she also plays in upstream. She's a member of the finance committee for the Northern California H&I service committee that manages all the money that we use to take literature into institutions that we serve. So with all of that said, it is my great pleasure to introduce my friend Joyce, who's going to be speaking tonight.
My name is Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. You know what? I love the moment when I get to an AA meeting and I am able to say, my name is Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. That brings such ease and comfort. Ease and comfort that I used to find in a bottle. I'd like to thank Amber for inviting me to come here tonight. And I would also like to welcome all of the people that came up here to this line and celebrated recovery. That is so incredibly awesome. I also want to share a little bit of information with you. When I was new and started coming to meetings and I came to a speaker meeting, I was like, oh my gosh, they must know something because they asked them to speak, right? It's a lie. We just saw the people that said yes, so don't be too impressed by that. But I can tell you that I don't know how to do this program perfectly. I don't know how to explain it to you perfectly. I can only share with you what has worked for me for the last 9 years, 8 months, and 22 days. I saw that on the website. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. You know, I'm not a very good big book thumper, if you will. There's a lot of things in the big book that mean a lot to me, so if you hear me paraphrase, it's how I remember it, okay? So you might see it a little bit different in the big book. One of the things that I really like in the big book is where it says there'll come a day where the alcoholic will forget with sufficient force the exact nature of their horrors, and they'll drink again. And that scares me. Honestly, that scares me. So in order to combat that, every morning when I wake up, I recognize that I can't have a conscious contact with my higher power because I've been asleep. So I spend a few minutes thinking about what it was like 9 years ago. When I woke up, there was shame, there was remorse, there was guilt, there was a lot of fear. I didn't know what I had said and who I'd hurt in my family, and I laid there waiting for them to wake up and see how they would respond to me so I knew what I did the night before. Because I don't ever want to forget what that feels like, because that's not what I have to do today. I get up in the morning and I hit my knees and I ask God for guidance through the day. I practice the first 3 steps of this program. I can't, He can, and I will let Him. And I get started with my day. Today I went to work. I actually show up for work on time, and I'm a fairly good employee. I'll tell you, I probably give about 80%. Because I still have this character defect. I don't want to set the bar too high so they expect me to do it all the time. But, you know, I look busy all the time. You know, I got to go home and get ready for the next day and come to a service committee meeting before this. And now I get to be here. And, you know, it may sound kind of boring. You know, that's not what I thought I was going to grow up and do. And it would be exciting. But today it's exciting because I get to do it sober. That's not how it was when I got here. I started drinking when I was 19, kind of an old age, you know, when you talk about alcoholics, but that's where it started for me. I grew up in a family. My dad was a cop here in Visalia. My mom was a church secretary. I had the desire to be the best. I was going to be the best kid, and I was going to do everything right. And I tried, and I always felt like I failed. I didn't feel like I fit in. I wanted to excel at everything I did, and my mind told me that I was never good enough. When I was 19, I didn't want to go to school anymore, and I wanted to be a police dispatcher. I thought it was the greatest job in the whole world because I get paid to talk, fabulous. I get to tell men where to go and what to do, and they can't argue with me, and I get paid for that. It was a perfect job for me. So I went into there. I was kind of like Mary Poppins, you know. I kind of have a Minnie Mouse voice. I present like Mary Poppins. I was very naive, and I learned really quickly that the world was a lot different than I believed it was. And shortly after I had been there for a bit, they took me out drinking with them after we got off shift. And I had my first drink, and I loved it. And I had my second drink, and that was better. And I had that ease and comfort, and I fit in, and I had a place, and I was funny, and I could be a part of, and I loved it. And I chased that for probably about the next 5 or 6 years. And I would get it. And I knew when I was getting to that perfect sweet spot, because my nose would get numb. And once my nose got numb, life got good. And then I was like, you know, I was getting to this ripe old age of 23, and I hadn't gotten married, I hadn't had any kids, you know, I was going to die a spinster, and I thought alcohol might be a problem, so I stopped, and I got married, I had a kid, we split up a couple times, I got back together with him, you know, the whole alcoholic dry person that I was, let's put another kid on it, that'll make it better, you know, so we did that, and I ended up 10 years into that. Oh, let me back up a minute. So after the second kid, things weren't going real well, but I still wasn't drinking, but I was just a dry, miserable drunk, and so we got divorced. You know, that's the best idea, right? Well, after about 6 months of that, you know, here I am now, a single mom. I've got a kid with a disability. I've got an older child. And, you know, who's going to want me, you know? And he started coming around again, showing a little bit of interest. So, of course, we get back together, right? Perfect thing to do. He says, well, you know, I think we should stop this divorce, you know, because now we're back together. And I'm like, no, we already got the papers almost done. Let's just, like, let it ride, you know? So we did. And then he talked me into marrying him again. And so I married him again. You know? And then I had to divorce him again 3 years later. It was really bad. You know, and so once I got divorced, I picked up that bottle. And I'll tell you, it took me about a week, and I was right back drinking where I was before. And I didn't think there was any problem with it. I was a functioning alcoholic. I went to work. I paid my bills. I didn't lose my kids. I was doing everything right. And I deserved it after all, right? Absolutely. And, you know, then there's that whole string of hymns, you know. For me, it was hymns, and because there's always someone. And, you know, we're always trying to make a relationship, and we don't know how to have one, but let's mess up a few more things. And, you know, and I'm always one of those people that, you know, I got to leave them and go back to them, leave them and go back to them, you know, because we got to beat a dead horse, make sure it's totally dead, and, you know, drag your kids through that whole garbage the whole time, and all the while drinking. And I went on like that for a long time, and I got to the point where I was drinking at home every night. I was making plans on how I wouldn't drink and drive. I would go to work, I would go to the liquor store and buy my bottle of Jack Daniels, bring it home. You have to drink a little bit. Now follow me on this one. You know, we don't want it to explode in the freezer, right? So you got to drink a little bit before you go to work. Put it in the freezer and perfect. And I don't have to drink and drive on the way home because my bottle is already in the freezer. Worked for me for a bit, but not for very long. And I finally got to the point where all I was is I was angry. I was mad all the time. I was mean, and I didn't even realize I was mean. I was telling everybody how to live their life better. You know, and if they would just listen to me, then I wouldn't have to drink because it was always their fault. And I was living with another guy. And just so you have an idea of the kind of relationships I had at this point, he told me I should probably move out and find somewhere else to live because he was going to see somebody else. And I was like, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I had nowhere else to go, and I had no money, right? He owed me, after all. So we spent the next year living in the same house, him seeing somebody else, me trying to prove he was having an affair, and him denying it. Now, if that's not crazy, I don't know what is. And, you know, I finally thought, well, maybe if I quit drinking, then this relationship will work out. We need that to work out, right? So I had been, like, thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew that's where you went if you wanted to get sober. And I would go online and take their 20 questions. And, you know, I would always get one that I could answer no to. I lied about it, but I could answer no to it. And, you know, I decided it was all rigged. I didn't know what AA was, but it was probably a cult, and they wanted you to all join, so they rigged the test. And then I would call the 800 number, and they would ask me if I wanted help, and I would hang up and hide because I thought they were going to find me, like they were 911 or something, I don't know. And, you know, I just did that for a long time, and finally one day I was like, okay, you know what, I've had it, so I'm going to go to a meeting. And I'm sure you guys can all recognize by looking at me how important I am, because I am very important. I'm very busy. You know, and it was going to work out really well for me to go to the noon meeting at Bridge Street Drunks because I was a drunk after all, and it fit into my schedule. And so I drove over there, and what I saw when I drove up was a bunch of little old men sitting around the table smoking cigarettes. And I'm like, I don't know what Alcoholics Anonymous is, but I think you got to share, and there's no way they're going to understand me. So I probably should go to the Alano Club. So I drove over to the Alano Club, and there's people with baggy pants and jeans and tattoos walking in there, and I'm like, well, I probably can't go in there. I worked at the police department, and I'm sure that we probably arrested them. You know, the sad thing about that, I'm sharing this with you because it's the delusion that alcohol took me to. I was a police dispatcher. Nobody saw me. They only heard me. Besides that, I'm like old enough to be most of your mother. You know, I wasn't working at the police department when those kids might have problems. But that's the craziness of alcoholism. You know, you have all these really great reasons why you can't be there. So I ended up in a women's meeting that night over at Trinity Church. And I'll tell you what, I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that. There was like 30 women sitting in a circle talking about what happened or what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And I'm like, I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't a bunch of people sitting in a room talking because that seems stupid. But I did feel much better because I wasn't as bad as all of them, and I was so glad they had a place to go. And I got all the way home that night, and I thought, you know what? That whole progress, not perfection thing, that's working because I didn't drink until I got all the way home that night. I was doing fine. So, you know, I was in a meeting last night and they said, you know, once you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, it ruins your drinking. That's true because you find out there's something different. And I don't know what it was, but I felt the desire to go back the next week. And when I went back, the lady bought me a big book, and to this day I still have a resentment against her because she didn't tell me to read it. You know, I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are. I need very specific direction. You don't just hand me a book and have an idea that I'm going to know to read it. You have to tell me. So I still have a resentment against her. But I, you know, that time after that meeting, I made it 3 days without drinking. I was on a roll, right? And I thought, you know, I'm feeling a bit shaky, and they were talking about in meetings you should call somebody. So that's my problem. I'm not calling somebody. Now, I didn't call the person that had 20 years of sobriety that bought me the big book. I called the girl that had 9 months of sobriety and was talking about struggling in the meeting. Because after all, I was going to help her. I had 3 days of sobriety, you know. So I called her up and we chatted, and she told me, you know, well, you're on the pink cloud and you're going to fall off of it. So I did. So I go to the meeting the next week, and, you know, I still thought it was baloney, but I still wanted to try because they seemed to have something I didn't have. And, you know, I gave it my best shot, and I didn't make it through that week either. And I said, okay, you know what the problem is? I'm only going to meetings on Tuesday night, and the weekends are the hardest because I don't have to go to work. So I should probably go to a meeting on a Friday afternoon, then I can make it through the weekend. So I braved it, and I went into the Alano Club, you know, drove up in my cool car and had my purse with my no money in it, but I thought I was rich. And I sat down, you know, clutching my purse, and there's a whole group of people in there, and they start the meeting. And to this day, I really honestly don't know what the secretary said that day. I can only tell you what my alcoholic brain told me he said. He had passed around the basket, and he said, you know, we don't have enough money to meet rent, so we're going to pass the basket around again, and hopefully those of you that can put a few extra dollars in it. I'm pretty sure that's what he said. What my brain heard was, you have enough money to support this whole meeting. What's your problem, bitch? And so I was really mad, you know, and I flounced out of that meeting. And today I'm really excited that that happened to me because I went on the worst drunk I'd ever been on in my life. I was drunk most of the weekend. I barely woke up, you know, to talk to my family. Sunday, I had to go out of town, so I didn't drink that day, but I had a hellacious hangover. Come Monday, I was following my same routine and getting my alcohol bottle. And by that point, you know, I was thinking I was running late to work. You know, I didn't punch a clock, so I don't know what late was to me, but I was late that day. So I took my bottle with me and drank half a, had a pint bottle of Jack Daniels. I drank half of it on the way from Tulare to Visalia. Showed up at work. Kept sitting there thinking about that bottle in the freezer, and I was like, you know, I might as well just go drink it, because that way I could get on with my life, you know, it won't be bugging me. So I did, ended up in a blackout drunk at work at 10:30 in the morning. Not sure how I got home. I remember bits and pieces of the road. Went in the house, passed out, and about 4 hours later woke up. And my first thought was, oh my God, did I hit somebody? So I ran out and checked my car. And then it dawned on me, it's like, oh my God, you know what? I might not have a job. And if I don't have a job, I might be an alcoholic. And I'm not an alcoholic. So I called my boss and got a hold of him. And bless his heart, he gave me one more chance. He told me, he says, I don't care what it is you need. You tell me what it is you need right now, but you have one chance, and I need you to come back to work. So I told him, I said, I'll be back tomorrow. It'll be fine. And the first thought that went through my mind was, I could drink the rest of today because I don't have to go to work till tomorrow. And I thought, oh, my God, you know what? Alcohol has made me insane. So I picked up the phone. I called the lady that bought me the big book, and I met her for dinner that night, and it was a joke, quite frankly, because I was still coming off this really bad drunk, you know, and I'm trying not to throw up my dinner that I paid my last $12 for. Then she tells me we're going to go to a meeting, and she takes me to a meditation meeting of all things. You're supposed to, like, sit for 10 minutes and meditate, you know, and here I am trying not to puke and not pass out. And I made it through that, and I don't remember a lot about that first meeting, but I do remember a girl saying that she liked the part of the big book that said, people that don't normally mix come together and they stay together. And, you know, that is what kept me coming back. And when I look around this room, there's not a single person in this room that I knew before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But today, there are a lot of friends in this room. There's people that I know that I could pick up the phone and call, and they would answer, and that together we can stay sober. I had the, like, blessing of being in service last night, and I just have to share this because I'm still kind of on a high about it. I was sitting in this room on this panel, and, you know, there's me accounting Mary Poppins that, you know, accidentally fell on an alcohol bottle one day, and there's an attorney, and there's a guy that, you know, is facing 27 to life after getting pulled out of a house on a SWAT call, and, you know, there's a traveling drunk that got 86 from the whole town, and there's this other guy that's just like, awesome. I'm not quite sure what he does for a living, but he's got the most awesome story. And I thought, you know what? We're a mess if we put us all together. But that's the beauty of the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous, each one of us comes together and we all support each other in sobriety, and we gain that unity that helps us stay sober. And when I was new, that's what I wanted, because I had spent my whole entire life alone. So after this meeting, this lady tells me, she says, okay, I'm coming to you. Oh, you're going to go to the women's meeting. This was on a Monday. You're going to go to the women's meeting on Tuesday night with me. And then I'm going to come to your house on Wednesday. We're going to start working the steps. And on Thursday, you're going to call Rayanne because it's her birthday. And I'm like, hold up, girlfriend. What happened to easy does it? I have a lot of stuff to do, and that's a lot. And she's like, okay, you're going to do it. That's what we're going to do. And I said, okay, well, I could probably do the other stuff, but I'm not going to call Rayanne because I don't even know Rayanne. I'm sure I don't like Rayanne. And I'm definitely not calling her and wishing her happy birthday. And she said, yes, you are. And I said, well, what if Rayanne doesn't answer? She says, well, then you could leave a message. I'm like, okay, so we get started in all this, and I called Rayanne, and I'll be damned, Rayanne answered the phone. And you know, Rayanne introduced me to the gift of one alcoholic talking to another and the importance of answering the phone. And today, because of that example that I was given and what it meant to me when I was new, I always answer my phone, or I will always call back, because there is nothing more beautiful than the opportunity to talk to another alcoholic. So I got started in this, and you know, I was trying to do the steps as much as I could, and quite frankly, I couldn't remember shit, so I was doing it right before I went to her house because I wanted to show her how smart I was, and she was never impressed at all. And after about 6 months, she told me I needed to get a service position, and I ended up going back to Bridge Street drunk on Thanksgiving because I needed to go to a meeting before Thanksgiving dinner, because otherwise I was pretty sure I was going to kill my family, and that would be a good place to go prior to. And I walked in there and I sat down, and for the first time I felt at home. And the most amazing thing happened, because they asked me how long I'd been sober, and I said, well, almost 6 months. And they're like, oh, well, that's great, because we need a secretary for our Friday morning meeting. And I'm like, oh, my God, they're seeing how wonderful I'm doing in this program, and they're making me the secretary. I'm like, of course I'll be the secretary. And so I showed up the next Friday morning, and I opened up the room, and I made the coffee and made sure all the books were straight, and 3 people showed up, because there's a men's meeting on Friday morning, and all the men in the group wanted to go over there, so they needed somebody else to run the meeting. So I was like, okay, it's a service commitment, and I did it for the next probably 2 years. I did that Friday morning meeting, and I showed up every morning, and I opened the door, and I listened. And every time that I thought that I was going to share, you know, because we would share on the daily reflections, I would try to read it the day before, so I would be, like, all prepared, so everybody could understand how good I was at this. And inevitably, I always read the wrong day, so I was never on track, but you know, I listened, and over the course of that first year, what I came to find out is that there were people coming into that room that were coming from the mission, and they were carrying everything they owned in a sack. And they would come in, and they would sit down, and they would participate in the meeting. And I drove up in my car before I went to work at my job, thinking that I was better than them. And these people that were coming in with everything they owned in a bag and sitting down and participating in the meeting had something I didn't have, but I wanted. They had hope. Hope for a different life. Hope for a relationship with a higher power that could show them a different way of life. And hope of staying sober if they did the things that were presented in this book. And I wanted hope. So my best thinking was that I needed a different sponsor, because the way she was presenting all this was like, you all were a cult, man. You know, and you drank the Kool-Aid, and I wasn't sure I wanted to drink it, and I certainly wasn't going to be able to follow all her rules. So I told her that I thanked her for her service, and I needed to find a different sponsor, and I was scared to death of what I was going to do with that. And I went back to the women's meeting, and I ran into this lady. Now, let me explain to you for a minute. This lady I met when I first got there, I hated her. I hated the way she looked. I hated the way she wore her hair. I hated everything that came out of her mouth. Every time she talked, I hated her. But she was the lady that talked to me after the meeting. And we stood in the parking lot and talked for about 2 hours. And this lady had a lot of sobriety. We're talking like, you know, close to 40 years. And she was a little bit more mature, and she looked very loving. And, you know, I just really wanted somebody to love me. So I invited her over to my house, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she does this thing. When she's busy. And she says, well, she says, I don't really like the name sponsor, but I could be your mentor. And we could get together, and we could go over the steps, and we can work on how to apply them in your life. And she said, but, she said, staying sober is your responsibility. I'm going to stay sober no matter what, and if you die, you die. And she got up and left. And I was like, well, maybe I won't call her again either. And I didn't for a bit. And I got really uncomfortable. And one night when I couldn't sleep, I thought, you know what? I probably need to read the big book because I want to read the big book. And I got out the big book and I started reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time because I wanted to read it. And I started finding my story on every page in the big book. And when I got through the first 163 pages, I called her. And I said, okay, I'm ready. And she said, you know, I was kind of getting a little bit worried because I thought maybe I overdid that with if you die, you die. I'm like, yeah, that's a little brutal. But, you know, we created a beautiful relationship over the next 8 years. And she taught me what I was missing in the beginning. You know, we come here and we need to work the steps. We need a lot of discipline because I don't know about you, but I didn't know how to do much of anything. And, but there comes a point where you have to learn to live the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it needs to become a way of life. And that's what she taught me through a lot of different courses of, you know, getting together and talking and working through issues that were coming up. And I'll share with you because she always, like, cringes when I share this story. So I'm going along. I got about 3 years of sobriety, and I'm getting plugged in, and I got the spiritual connection going, and my life, I didn't want to talk too long, sorry. So I got my life going and everything. And I was dealing with a really hard problem, and I knew that I could find the answer to it if I went to meetings. And one day I went to a meeting, and I heard the answer to the problem I was having. And it was like, you know, this light bulb came on, and I was all excited, and everything was wonderful. And I got in my car, and I'm like hyped up, and I'm like, wow, I think I had a spiritual awakening, but I'm not really sure, you know. And so I called her, and we were talking about it, and you know, she's like, yeah, that's a spiritual awakening when everything just sort of falls into place and it makes sense. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. And I said, but quite frankly, I don't think I ever want to do that again. And she's like, why? And I said, well, that was too many emotions. You know, I wanted to laugh, I wanted to cry, I was happy, I was sad. I just don't think I ever want to do that again. And she says, well, why don't you think about it as a spiritual orgasm? And I went, oh, you know what? I would do that again. So, you know, she always made it fun. And we always kept it real. You know what? This is a life-threatening disease. You know, we're very blessed that we come in here. We have the steps to guide us. We have the traditions to help us get along with our groups and our other people. And we have the concepts that help us get along with the outside world. You know, we didn't come here to get sober and live our lives in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We came here to become productive members of society. And, you know, that's challenging when we take it outside of these rooms because nobody understands the stuff that goes on in our heads. So I was then about 3.5 years sober, and she told me that I needed to join AA. I don't know what the hell she's talking about. You know, I'd been going to a lot of meetings, doing service commitments. And so I knew if I went to a meeting that I would, you know, if I kept going to meetings, I'd figure out what she's talking about. And I kept hearing somebody talk about H and I. And I was like, oh, you know what? That kind of sounds like something I would want to do. But here I am like 3 years sober and I still can't remember shit to save my life, you know. I remembered what H and I was. I remember they were meeting at the Alana Club, but the date and time I could not remember. So I start asking around and they tell me, well, you can go out to county jail, but you need to get an application for a clearance and you need to ask Melanie. Well, you know, sometimes anonymity is not the greatest thing because there's a few Melanies. You know, so I'm going around the meetings to find the Melanie that has an application, and finally it wasn't Melanie, it was Martha that gave me an application, and I said, what do I do with this application after I fill it out? And they said, well, you just take it to the Alana Club and you can put it up on the bulletin board and somebody will pick it up. And I'm like, to get cleared for county jail, you got to give your social security number, your address, all kinds of pertinent personal information. Now, quite frankly, I was a financial mess. Nobody would really want to steal my identity, but it's the only one I had, so I didn't want to really give it away. So they said, hey, you know what? You need to talk to this guy named Bill Hatzman. I'm like, I don't know who that is. But I got a hold of him on the phone, and I met him at the Alano Club, and I gave him my application, and Bill, I don't know how many of you know Bill real well.
Mm-hmm.
Bill is like, hey, so, you know, you could probably be a speaker at our Wednesday night meeting, and we need a greeter over at this meeting, and how about you come over here? And I'm so grateful to Bill because he got me into service in a way that I couldn't even imagine. I got to go on an 8-9 panel last night, and I was driving home with one of my friends, and she said, every time we get in the car together to go or come from the 8-9 panel, she always tells me, she says, I remember when you started out in 8-9, you said, I don't think this is for me. I don't like it at all. I'm probably going to quit. And here I am 8 years later, you know, holding positions and, like, so jazzed about recovery and hospital and institution work. It's amazing what service work will do to change your life. So I did. I got involved in H&I. You know, it's like every service commitment in AA. You know, you're not special because they ask you to do it. You're probably the only person that says yes. So go ahead and say yes. You know, and I learned really quickly because I walked in the room the first time and they're like, hey, we don't have a women's coordinator out at county jail. Why don't you be that? And I'm like, why don't I go out to county jail first, you know, and see how that goes. And so I went to that. And then they said a couple years into that, the area chair is like, I'm going to step down from this position, and we've never had a woman area chair. I think you should do it. You know, the same four people in the room that had always been there. And so I did. And, you know, I learned that by that point I knew they didn't ask me to do it because I was the best person for the job. They asked me to do it because I said yes. But that doesn't mean that that's where I have to stop. I can do everything I can do to find out how to be the best area chair that I can be. There is nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous that you will ever be asked to do that they don't have a frickin' pamphlet for to tell you how to do it. Believe me. If you can't find it, call me. I'll help you find it. There's a million people that have done the position before. They're going to show you how to do it. They're going to mentor you. They're going to teach you. And I've grown in this position to a point today where the person that came in here that would tell you that I was so important and I didn't have time, had nothing but time when it comes to recovery. Because if I don't put my recovery first, everything else that I think is important is gone. You know, one of the most incredible things I enjoy in Alcoholics Anonymous is hospital and institution work. We've got this really nifty, like, list of volunteers, and I hadn't been in the facility coordinator position for a while, and it's, like, super fun. You know, I go down the list. Some of the people I know, some of them I don't. I call them up. They say, oh, yeah, I'll go to the panel. It's kind of like opening that box of Cracker Jacks, looking for the prize at the bottom. You don't know what you're going to get. You know, we go into the facilities. We bring people that have real authentic, real recovery stories. They have a desire to stay sober and they want to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't tell you the gratitude and joy that brings me to be a part of that. You know, today I can tell you that the person that didn't think I was that bad, I lied, I cheated, I stole from every person I knew. I used every person I knew. When you were no longer of a need to me, I had no need for you. I only paid my car payment because I thought that's where I was going to end up living, and I wanted to have a place to live. I am the best person at not doing a job and looking like you're doing a job. It took me 3 years to get my job all straightened out when I got sober. My kids that I didn't lose to the judicial system hated my guts, but they didn't have anywhere else to go. I didn't spend time in a jail cell. My jailer was the bottle of a Jack Daniels, and it got smaller and smaller because that's all I could afford. So today I can tell you that everything that I thought that made me different actually made me the same. Today I know that I'm not better than, but I'm not less than either. Today I stay a part of. And as long as I stay a part of, then I get to stay sober and have other alcoholics stay sober, and together we can do this. So thank you very much for having me. All right, let's give George another round of applause.